Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
The Torah section called Ki Tisa, which covers Exodus chapter 30, starting in verse 11, goes through chapter 34, and picked up passages there in 1 Kings chapter 18 and in 2 Corinthians chapter 3. We have a question here to begin with.
A question and comment, a couple of Shabbats ago, I asked if during the 400 plus years they're in captivity, if they knew about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, etc. And this here confirms, I believe, that he did, because Moses is saying in verse 13, chapter 30, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your offsprings. So he's confirming the promise back to Moses to
God. Yes. The Lord certainly didn't forget that. And so, you know, you had the cry that was going up for relief, because it is very interesting that you note that, because a similar thing you could say is a parallel with the crying out that the prophet Daniel did near the time when the 70 years that was foretold by the prophet Jeremiah of the that exile, the Babylonian exile, when that was going to end. In a similar realm, you have the people crying out for relief. And when you see the timing, as we saw during the Exodus time period, like in Exodus 19, when it mentions that the very day, and connecting that back to the time of Abraham, that you'll see that perhaps there was some sort of an expectation that, hey, these days that were foretold to Abraham, that the people were going to go down into Mitzrayim and then come back up again, that maybe those days were getting to be coming to an end. So it's a good observation there. All right, so we are going to be taking a look at some key aspects of this particular passage. We saw that it covers a few items in there that seems like a grab bag of items. We got the talking about a census. I just decided to take a census here and in this particular time period, in the midst of talking about the construction, or how the tabernacle, the dwelling place, the tent of meeting, was going to be taken care of. Rose, you have your hand up there.
Oh, I just wanted to make a comment in chapter 32, meaning no disrespect to God, but I find it a little comical, as when I was a parent, when the children were good, they were mine. When they were naughty, they belonged to my husband. So I think it's kind of cute. Well, it's not really cute, but in my mind, it's kind of, you know, being a parent, you know, God was angry with the people and said that they were Moses' children and not his children.
Yeah, definitely a bit of a foreshadowing of the intercessor. Is that okay? Well, are you going to shift blame here? And the interesting aspect that you see is that the Moshe decides that he is going to accept the blame. He is going to accept all of the vitriol that is passed down, that would be passed down to Israel. He said, I will take it upon me instead of the people. And it's an interesting thing, because it's not like Moshe is just letting this slide, because when he heard that was going on, he gave a good hint of what was going on when Yehoshua was saying, hey, I hear it sounds like a sound of war down there. And you see in the poetic verse, he's given a hint of what it is that is actually going on down there. It's not a sound of war, or triumph, or defeat, but a song that is going on. Yes, Danielle, you have a comment or a question over there.
I have a question. It talks about how, Moses convinces God, like, oh, don't have as much anger on them. But the Bible tells us God doesn't change his mind. So what was that about, like?
Very interesting, because you see a similar thing in what other book with a prophet that's having an encounter? I'll give you a hint. Involves a sea creature in a boat. Yes, Jonah. Well, what's a very interesting thing with the parallel there? Because what was the message that was given to Jonah to tell Nineveh? A very, very bad, bad city. And repent for 30 days, and the city will be what? Overturned. Yes, and it's a very interesting thing because it's an ambiguous term. The ambiguous term is that it will be overturned. Well, it could mean destroyed, or it mean turned over. Well, a very interesting thing is what is another term that we use for turning over. It's a different word, or teshuv, and that's the verb form, or teshuvah, to turn around. So one, talked it to Nineveh, it's facing one way, and then you turn it over another way. Or with shuva, teshuv is to actually go a different direction. You're headed one direction, and then you turn and go another direction. And the idea is that you're headed one direction, and so you head a different direction, preferably the way that you came, so that you would head back to the path. The place where you got off the path, you would head back to the path. Yeah, you do a U-turn. So that is an interesting picture of what we have going here to this particular people. Well, what do you see is a very interesting picture? That Jonah gives the message to Nineveh, hey, you've got 30 days and you'll be overturned. There wasn't any if clause, then clause, nothing. It says 30 days and there will be an overturning that will happen. Well, Nineveh was overturned. What did they do? They turned around. They did teshuvah. They repented. And it says they were in such a state of repentance that they were even putting on sackcloth and ashes, which is an ancient form of saying we are debasing ourselves from where we think we are in as an esteem position to being beggars, to being the people of death and dirt. So that sign was, hey, we are turning around, even down to the livestock, we're turning around in everything that we do. So that picture was, okay, Nineveh was turned over. So then what happened at the end of the 30 days? They turned around. So then the hammer that was going to fall on Nineveh, that turned around as well. Well, what was happening in this particular case? This hammer was going to fall. The Lord is saying, basically, hey, Moshe, get out of my way so I can lay waste. But what did Moshe do? He stood in the way and said, I will continue to stand in the way. Let the hammer fall on me. Don't swing your hammer of wrath on the people. They deserved it, and you could see Moshe's reaction to what was going on. He wasn't soft-pedaling it. It was an absolute offense what they did to the one who took them out. We see in the New Covenant prophecy in Jeremiah 31, it's like, I took you out even though I was a husband to you. It wasn't like I was going to be your slave master. I was going to be the one who was going to take you into the community, to a family. But What instead did you want? Something else. So that's a very interesting picture that we have of these aspects in the midst of all of this talking about how the tabernacle and this pattern that's being given. So Moshe's up on the mountain, he's getting the idea of the pattern. And while he's up there, people are, I don't know. He's gone. We don't know what happened to him. So then you have Aharon being directed, hey, what are we going to do about the situation? He's gone. So we want something to represent that which took us out of Mitzrayim. I mean, that's amazing that you see the exact language that you saw out the mountain that the Lord said, hey, I am, that's like the first commandment, the first word. I am the Lord your God who did what? Who took you out of the house of bondage, took you out of Mitzrayim. You will have no other gods before me. So what do they say? Here is our God who took us out of the land of Mitzrayim, the land of bondage. So the Lord said specifically, hey, don't have any other gods representations in my face. And they said, well, we will make one. We will make a representation of God and say, this is what took us out of the house of bondage. So a very interesting picture with that. But the interesting aspects that are also being revealed in this pattern about also the descriptions of the basin and the oil and the incense, and especially about the oil, was it just kind of the wing it recipe? And the perfume, the incense, was that a wing it recipe? No, it was a very specific one, specific proportions. And the instructions for both were, you're not going to use this for common use. Do not use these same proportions to make something else. Because especially with if you're using something that's a fragrant oil or an incense, what happens when you burn something that has a smell to it? It's an aroma to the Lord, but it's also a memory. You remember smells, don't you? You remember if you've got pleasant memories around things. And if you have unpleasant memories about certain smells, you remember those as well. So when you smell them again, what happens? You remember. So, thus, if there is a certain smell and it is being burned there in the tabernacle, it is to remind the priesthood of what? The boss, the one who led them out. If you smell that anywhere else, you're like, oh, well, then that's not a special thing. You're back to the okay, maybe there is something else that took us out of the land of Egypt, not some specific one in a specific place that took us out of the house of bondage. So, a special oil for anointing, these things are being set apart, made holy. That's what holy means. Kadosh is to set apart. It's in one place, and you're saying it is now going to be considered in a completely different category. Some other, a part of the other. So, then when in the midst of this, then you have instructions for the Shabbat. So, okay, you've got instructions for the tabernacle, making special oil, which sets things apart. You make special incense, which sets things apart. Then in the midst of this, you have the instructions about the Shabbat. Does that seem like a non sequitur? Something that doesn't fit together? Or what is the whole instruction about the Shabbat in the Ten Commandments? The fourth commandment is, you know, remember the Shabbat day, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, for in 6 days you are to labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Shabbat of the Lord your God. Okay, so what then do you have? 6 days where you do your work and your labor. The seventh day is what from the other six? Set apart. So there you go. You have another thing of saying, okay, you've got six normal days, ordinary days. The seventh day is set apart. Why? Is it like what Pharaoh was saying back, you know, before the plagues? Oh, you want to go off because you're lazy. You just want a day off because you're lazy. You just want to goof off, have a good time. It's set apart for doing what? It says it right there in the fourth commandment back there in Exodus 20. To remember the Sabbath day. And it goes on in verses 8 through 11 and talks about for what or because of what. In 6 days, the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in them. And then he rested or he stopped on the seventh day. So that is talking about the capstone of it. So that in a case, it's saying, hey, the Lord created all that is around us, everything. The Lord is above all that is made. So thus, you know, when you talk about worshiping the tree, the rock, or whatever of the peoples of the nations do, you see that's a futile thing because instead you are being freed from bondage by the one who made the trees, the rocks, and everything. So thus, to say the Lord is in the tree, in the rock, in the sky, in the bush, in the stream, in the river, in the water, in the seas, is absurd because you're talking about the one who created them. And that was when we were talking about the crossing of the Red Sea, that was a big lesson because at the time period in Canaan, there was a very popular myth going on about the Baals. And one of those Baals or lords, masters, the spiritual masters, had this war with the sea creature, Yam. Yam was one of their deities that they had. They had Baal, many Baals, and then you had those that had wars with another deity, and that was Yam in the sea. So there was a war that was going on, according to what you see in popular Canaanite mythologies of the time period. So the only reason why this Baal was able to conquer Yam was because he worked out a deal so he could get it over on Baal's father to gain control. But what was the lesson then of the splitting of the sea? The creator of heaven and earth and the seas and all that are in them just said, waters, split. There's no negotiation, no deals, no backroom, you know, handshakes and passing cash back and forth. No. The Lord breathed, talks about poetically in the Psalms, he breathed with his nostrils and poof, the sea opened. Why? It was responding to the one who made it. It could do no other. So, thus, the created order responds to the one who created. It has to follow its master, the creator of heaven and earth. Yes, so there is no reason for having any sort of war between or debate between who is in charge and who is not. And that is what we see in the passage we saw in 1 Kings chapter 18. There is a battle there with the Baals. And as we know, there were many different flavors of Baals that were out there, lords of thunder, lords of this and lords of that, Lord of the Flies even. And that these different lords, and you have the interaction there on Mount Carmel and a war between them and who is going to win. So that's something we'll get at a little bit later. But in the midst of this, you've got two tablets, the two tablets that Moshe brings down, the tablets of the words of God, the Ten Commandments, the ones that he wrote on. He brought those down. But those first set destroyed at the mountain. Destroyed at the base of the mountain because what? Moshe saw what was going on there. They decided the first commandment, which was written on those tablets, said, I am the one who took you out of Mitzrayim. Have no other gods before me. There's the golden calf at the bottom of the mountain. They decided to break that, right? One at the top. So that got destroyed. Yes, Christine, you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, just some rabbinical thought behind that, too. The first set of tablets, they study, and I thought it was interesting, although it doesn't appear in the word, so I'm just throwing it out there. Interesting because they said that the words of the tablet, which were written with the fingers of God, leaped off the stones, and then the stones became so heavy. So I don't know if they're trying to, you know, shield Moshe and his temper, where he clearly says in the scriptures that he threw it down, but I like the notion that the words, because it's even spoken about that when Hashem spoke, it was the vibrations of the letters that went out. And so I like the imagery of the letters written by the finger of God just leaping off the stone tablets and leaving, that the presence and the words just left. So it's an interesting notion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting observation on that reflection of the words being alive. Now, the difference that we have there is you have the tablets have the handwriting of God on them, written by the hand of God. First set, both the tablets and the words written by God. What did it say about the calf at the bottom of the hill that Aharon commissioned? They got the gold from their earrings. They melted them down. They fashioned it into, and it said they also used graving. So they were carving in and working it as well. So they were carving in to something as well. But what were they making? This was what they were fashioning of it. And they were saying, this is the Elohim that took us out of the land of Egypt. So that is the creation. But the thing is that, oh, a challenge. Because when the people get into the land, what are they going to see? They're going to see more bulls. And they're going to see more Elohim. So how do you know which one actually delivered you out of the house of bondage? It could be Baal Zebub. It could be Baal Zephon. How do you know? It could be. It could not be. Because if the majority of the people around there and people in high places are saying, hey, it's Baal Zephon, the Lord of the North. He's the one who delivered you out of the house of bondage. How do you know? And that is one of the things that's being challenged there at the base of the mountain. So you have the graving into the tablets of the finger of God, or you've got the graving into gold down at the base of the mountain, saying, well, who do you listen to? Do I listen to the words that tell me things, that give me the testimony of who it is who delivered me out of the house of bondage? Or I go with whatever meaning I put onto things, that I eat and I drink and I rise up to play. And that's what it means to serve the Elohim who took me out of the house of bondage. I don't have to go along with what is written on these tablets. I can just make it up as I go along and fashion it into whatever I want it to be. Yes, Eski, we have a comment or a question over there.
So I had a question based on with the calf being
already, from my understanding of the reading, when Aharon replied to Moses, he said that the people gave me the gold, put it into the thing, and then out came this calf.
It's a very curious way that is fashioned, because in one sense they say that they took the gold and melted it down and they actually used the graving thing on it. But what does Aharon tell Moshe when he comes down? He goes, "How did you let this happen?" And he said, "Well, I took the gold and stuff like this, and then it just came out as this."
Yeah.
We had no control over it. This was like, you know, the one people come up with the idea of automatic writing, where you get these visions from beyond, and then you just write, and you're getting some sort of revelation. It's a form of divination. Well, what do you expect? You're just automatic engraving. You're just kind of engraving on something, and oh, it's a calf. No, the calves were common in the deities of the time period, because we see those calves being in various impressions, and we see it later on in the kind of the passage when we get to it and talking about Eliyahu up on the mountain of Carmel, that this was a thing in the northern kingdom of Israel. They had not just one golden calf, they had two of them, north and south. Because why? Calves are common. Bulls are common in as a representation of deity. Why? Strength. Yes, indeed. I mean, if you're talking about agricultural economies, they are the bulldozers of the time period. The bulldozers, the tractors. Yes, Danielle, you have a comment or a question.
I find it funny how Moshe dealt with it, because it says that he ground up the calf and then put it into a drink and then made them drink the ground up calf, which is kind of weird. Like, why would you?
It's a very, very interesting thing, because there actually is, when we talk about representations of calves, There's also representations in ancient Near East literature of doing just that with gods, as basically how you destroy the deities of some other community is you go through these various things of grinding them up and basically you consume them. But the point is that these rituals that were done in ancient Near East of doing that was to basically conquer a foreign deity, but this was, you are consuming it yourself. You like it so much, you're going to drink it in. Is this what you want to take into yourself? Do you want to eat and drink this? Oh, yes, you will. You will eat and drink it. Kind of makes you think of something else in the Gospels, in the Gospel of John. Eat my flesh and drink my blood. That is a very ancient idea, is a fact of how you, as a metaphor of how you take in the deity. But in the pagan cultures, this was done about a very physical thing. But one of the lessons here is that the creator of heaven and earth doesn't work that way. It's part of the lessons of the tabernacle, and a part of the lessons of the golden calf in here. The creator of heaven and earth is not like the nations that you're going in to be among. This is not just, you just take their practices, hey, that looks kind of cool. You know, they got a cool smoke machine and laser light show. We'll just kind of bring that in there. No, and it says, no, this is not, you don't take their practices that are leading you off into a different direction and incorporate them in. There is a thing that they are leading you toward with those practices. Don't do those things that the other nations are doing in the service of their deities, especially the ones that are specifically said, no, they're leading you in a different direction. Rather, and what do you then see? How then do you relate to to the creator of heaven and earth. That's also a part of the passage we see today. Moshe is saying, show me your glory. Who is the one who is leading us out of the house of bondage, out of Mitzrayim? Show me your glory. And he said, I will make all my goodness pass before you. And then declared the name of the Lord. Loving kindness, steadfastness, all these elements. That is the name, the reputation of the Lord. You don't need to make it into metal. It is a representation of what the Lord does. That is going to be the message. So when Moshe is saying, who is going to go with us? The Lord then reveals, oh, this is who is going with you. Not notice it because of it's in gold or it looks like a calf or it looks like a bird or it looks like this or it looks like that. No, it is what is its name? What is the name of the deity that is going with you, the creator of heaven and earth? That's number one. So it is then supreme over everything else that is going on. So as we kind of move on into this further, one thing to note about the various elements that were talked about in this particular passage today, about the washing, that you're supposed to wash your hands and your feet, the priests that are going in and out. We mentioned this a little bit on our last Torah study with the discussion of this, is that the priests were to wash their hands and feet before they go in to the holy place. And it says, so that you will not die. Is it just because of you have dirty feet that you're going to die? No, it's disrespect. It's forgetting that you are approaching the other, the total other of heaven and earth. You are approaching towards the presence of the creator of heaven and earth, who has decided to make a presence known and exist on earth, which is bizarre when you think about that. How you see the psalmist was talking about, how can anything the heavens contain you? And the David talks about this, and Solomon talks about this. Solomon especially, when he's praying for the dedication of the temple. How can this house contain you? You don't live in houses. You decide to place your presence there, and we see with the ark that the presence is appearing between the cherubim, or the cherubs that are on the top of the Ark of the Testimony, the Ark of the Covenant, that is where the presence resides and alights, but that doesn't mean that is the only place where the creator of heaven and earth is. So it is a cleansing. As you approach the presence of God, you must be cleansed of the what you were and what conditions that you're in, just in the realm of where we are now. And then when you go into the area where the oil is, the oil that's set aside for anointing, the oil that is set aside for the light, that is a place where you remember you've got the table of bread on one side, and then you've got the menorah on the other, the lampstand on the other. And the lampstand is shining light onto what is in the holy place. And those things that are there are the table of bread, 12 loaves of bread, talking about the one picture you can get from that is the body of the nation, and then the altar of incense. So that isn't an area where the deeds of the people, the bread, is being observed by the light of God. So with that, then you have the altar of incense. And it's mentioned a little bit, but when we get to the Day of Atonement, as is described in Leviticus 16, it talks about that before the high priest is to go in behind the veil to the Holy of Holies to minister before the Ark of the Testimony, it must take this incense and make a cloud as a covering. And this cloud of the covering is, you see in the book of Revelation, represented with prayers of the holy ones. That the prayers of the congregation of the Lord, the prayers of the people of God, is a shroud that shields us, that covers us as we go into the presence of God. So that is a beautiful picture as we look at it, of the various elements of what God does, washing us, enlightening us, showing us, seeing what we're doing, empowering us, and then covering us and giving us a shrouding as we go into the presence of God. Not because of how fantastic we are waltzing into the presence of God, but a covering is upon us before we go in. So, let's take a look at the encounter up there that we have in 1 Kings chapter 18. Now, this is a part of a larger passage, as always. Lots of context here involved of this particular encounter that we dropped into with our Haftarah reading. Yes, Anne, you got your hand up there with a comment or a question.
I realized that the laver is where they wash their hands. Is that
and
right?
And their feet.
Well, do they use the same water?
Use the same water?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, some of what's reflected is, yes, they would be changing that out. So
each time.
I don't know about changing each time, but it was changed out regularly. So, yeah.
Okay.
That's just what the some of the traditions call for on that. And when you're talking about that, it would just make sense that when you're talking about if you're going into a place and you've got dirt on your feet and you've got dirty water, that if you're talking about the place where you're approaching the presence of God, you would not want that to just be a muddy puddle. It just continually. Because if the emphasis throughout the entire construction of this is the otherness of God, you would think that the what you would do inside of it that would promote that. When you see that the priesthood starts to forget the otherness of God and they start bringing in diseased animals for the offerings, etc., you see the decline downhill. Because inside, that kind of a heart that would prompt you to, instead of bringing your best, to just bring whatever to the presence of God, you are now taking the reputation of the Creator of heaven and earth and bringing it down at least to your own level, maybe even below your level. Because would you treat a friend like that? No. You wouldn't treat anybody with any sort of significance by giving the least, giving the worst, giving stuff that you just want to slough off. That's not a response from the heart, a heart transformation that's involved. Yes, Carrie, you have a comment or a question there.
I was just thinking, obviously, it would still have to be changed out, but also just noting that the oils in that sacred blend, they kill viruses, they're antiseptic, they kill bacteria, all that. So having the utensils and everything coated with that oil on a daily basis actually helped prevent disease from the priests.
Yeah. We kind of promote that picture of when it mentions about the things inside the house of God being, you know, not leavened. That's a message that's coming through. You don't want the rot decay to be going through, because We were talking about functionally when you see some of the what's recorded in Josephus about what was happening with the offerings around Passover time in Jerusalem in the first century. Whole lot of lambs, hundreds of thousands that were going on there. Now, just functionally, you know, if you've been around any sort of either hunting or on a farm or this and that, you know what can go into one animal. Just imagine hundreds of thousands of animals. So you've got to really be on your A game for cleanliness. Otherwise, what can happen soon? If you've ever been to any sort of farm where the people just don't care or don't know about hygiene, it's dicey at best. And you're like, you don't want to eat food that comes from it. And then when you're thinking about this being a representation of your approaching the creator of heaven and earth, and like, if we don't want to be around this place because it stinks or whatever, flies, etc., would we want the creator of heaven and earth to be dwelling in a place like this? No, certainly not. So when we look at the encounter that the prophet Eliyahu was having up there on Mount Carmel, is an interesting perspective when we look back at Sinai, because as we were mentioning at the outset, not just one golden calf that was there in the northern kingdom, but two. So a little bit of a look on a map here of some of the elements of this particular situation. So you have Mount Carmel right here next to the sea. So modern day, you'll see on the map, it says Haifa. So if you know kind of the geography of Israel, Haifa, that's just right there at the base of the mountain. We'll take a look at that in more detail. But Carmel is up here in the northern kingdom area, and it's kind of, you can see across to what, say, the modern day Golan Heights area, where you have a lot of the conflict. So a lot of the conflict that you hear about today up in Lebanon, well, that's up here in ancient Phoenicia area. And Golan Heights, ancient Syria, modern-day Syria. So down here at Carmel, very interestingly enough, located near Megiddo and that area, or the area of Harmageddon. And also, a very interesting thing to note is that this, again, is in the northern kingdom of Israel. The southern kingdom of Israel is down toward the southern part, so kind of the Jerusalem area and sort of south. Now, you'll see in, if you were to read on in 1 Kings and you get into chapter 19, chapter 20, it talks about that Eliyahu fled, you know, after wiping out hundreds of the prophets of Baal and Asherah, that didn't sit well with Jezebel, because she was one of the main ringleaders of taking the northern kingdom downhill, as in bringing in all of these foreign and these deities in. So she went after him, and he fled down into the kingdom of Yehuda. So that's just a geographical reference. Now, just taking a look at where things are at here today. This is a view of Mount Hermon. This is seen from Tel Dan, which is where one of the calves was. When it talks about there being one in the north, one in the south, this is the area of where the northern calf was. And they've actually excavated a site, which is right around the area of that Don area. So this is showing here that in Tel Don, this is thought to be a location of where you had King Jeroboam the First set up a worship center for the golden calf. And where they have excavated, they found an area that would fit for an altar, and then an upper area that would fit for a place where the actual golden calf would be. So the lower area with the altar, and then the upper area, which would have, and you see here is where a higher platform is, and that's thought to be where you actually had the golden calf sitting. So when you think about this is not just people hallucinating in the wilderness. This is stuff happened in history, and they were drawn off by the practices of the people around them to the high places. Yes, indeed. So you had the high places here on these particular mountains. So this in particular picture is a picture of Mount Carmel. And Mount Carmel, as we'll see, is you can actually see modern day today. Is you can look down from it and see the modern city of Haifa and the port there of Haifa. So when it talks about being there near the ocean, and you see later on being able to look out over the ocean and see a cloud forming, which was going to be the end of this drought. Now, as a lot of people have commented over the centuries, that this was a major drought that was going on, and it was a drought that Eliyahu said was going to come. This drought was going to come upon them. Change your ways. You know, you think that you just have a drought of the word. Well, there's going to be an actual drought that's going to come, and it's going to last for years. So we here in this particular area experienced a drought lasted 3 years, and we saw what was going on with our reservoirs as they were going down, 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 and way, way down near the bottom. And some of them even almost ran completely dry and empty where the reservoirs were. Now, when you were noting on the particular altar that you see Eliyahu, he rebuilt an altar and had the stones, the 12 stones for the 12 tribes, put that up there as to be a marker, remind people, hey, you need to rebuild a pillar of a sort of what was there before. Rebuild the nation, the 12 tribes that have fallen apart, fallen into disuse, and gone on into another deity. Deities gone after, completely lost her way from what we see in Sinai. I'm the Lord your God who took you out of the house of bondage. Have no other gods before me. Gone from that as being one of the key foundational statements for Israel to, hey, we're having lots of deities here. And it's basically a carnival of all sorts of Canaanite deities and gods. We're just bringing them all in, having a great time. Yes, a great kind of carnival of different beliefs, putting them all together. But what we see here is a progression that has led up to this point. And it really starts in 1 Kings chapter 12 and talking about what was some of the major requirements for kings. And we'll see, we'll see when we get into Deuteronomy, especially Deuteronomy 17, that there are four major requirements for the kings. There, don't multiply your horses, don't multiply your wives, don't multiply your wealth, and do write for yourself a copy of the Torah. Seek understanding and seek to understand it. Ask questions. That's what the deities are supposed to do. And we see that from the first kings of Israel, that went downhill. Solomon, as we've noted in previous years, is just completely threw that out the window as far as being a directive. Multiply horses, he multiplied wives, lots and lots of wives, and with those, lots of, you could say, treaties. Because a lot in the ancient world, especially with the royalty, marriages were treaties. So with all of these wives were coming all sorts of treaties and interdependencies. And what does the word say that all of these wives led to? They led him astray. They led his heart astray, where his emotions were, where his thinking was no longer toward the one who took Israel out of the house of bondage. No, rather toward the high places and the places other than the place of God. So what happens then if you start forgetting where you come from? You are adrift. You no longer have any sort of recollection or even care of where you were supposed to be going. You know what happens in relationships, in companies, in families, when you just start losing any sort of concept of why you started out doing this? What happens? If you're in a friendship and you kind of forget what it is that drew you together, they use the term, well, we drifted apart. Well, why? Why did you drift apart? There was not the continual cementing and re-cementing of why it is that you have this bond together. Or it may be that, you know, for people that have come out of a lifestyle, you've come out of your house of bondage, it may be that those friends, those acquaintances you had before, were connected to a type of lifestyle that is best left behind. So in that case, you're revisiting the reason why you have this friendship to begin with and say, that's not really going in the right direction. So then you say, okay, I need to make this break. But within our families, we can have this period of where you just stop remembering why it is that you are together, that you are part of a family that should what? Have a legacy that you bring forward. Well, what is your family's legacy? What, that you just get around and stuff yourselves on Thanksgiving? Or is it that you are doing what from generation to generation? Teaching, passing something on from generation to generation. Because stuff disappears, gets neglected, people forget what it's even for anymore. I mean, there's a whole part of archaeology is trying to figure out what is all this stuff that we find and we dig up. What was it there for? If nobody talked about it or anything, you have really no idea, and people can come up with all kinds of fanciful stories of what people may have used it for or what they thought about this or that. But if there's no legacy that you're passing on, then what is it there for? And you see a similar battle there between Sinai and the calf. The legacy that's being passed on is on the tablets. It's coming down the hill with the shining face of Moshe. And we saw that in our passage that we looked at in 2 Corinthians chapter 3. So what is the legacy that people should be looking at? Moshe had a personal connection with the creator of heaven and earth. This is not about stuff written on stone. It was about the one who wrote it on the stone. And why he wrote it on the stone, and why those writings on the stone are for what? For your good, as he talks about as we get into Deuteronomy. These things are for your good, to make you to prosper in the land, and ultimately to bring through this promise that was given to Abraham, that through them all the world would be blessed. And it's all a part about what is being passed down from one generation to the next. The testimony that has been written on those stones with the writing. But more than that, when you see that Moshe was going into the tent of meeting and meeting with God as one meets with a friend, you are seeing there that this is more than stuff that is written on stone. It is written upon what? It's written upon your heart. It's in your emotions, through your mind, what you're thinking about. And thus, that is where we have in the Shema that you teach these things as you go along the way. When you rise up and when you go to sleep, you're teaching these things from one generation to the next. These are the important things to pass along, not the knickknacks. Yes. Yes, Christine.
Sorry for this anecdotal story, but this morning, my father had said to me, Well, he gave honor and gratitude for being able to stay with me, and we're facing not a unique situation of, So we have got our own struggles ahead of us, but what I wanted to bring up is that when I was speaking with him, I mentioned my brother and my two sisters, and he started shaking his head, and I said, "Dad, you raised us biblically. It's written on our hearts. You know, it's just something that I can do for you right now, but it's written in our hearts." And I wanted to reassure him that what he taught us did resonate and make a difference, you know, and if he's thanking me now, it's a result of what he's taught me. And it's also with my brother and my two sisters, even though they aren't able to fulfill this, their heart is with him and would want to do this. And it's important.
Well, I mean, isn't that one of the greatest blessings that we can pass on from one generation to the next? I mean, I heard my mother recently was telling me something similar, wondering, if she accomplished anything in her life. And I just said, "Well, hey, look, Mom, I love the Word. I stayed out of debt. You taught me about staying out of debt. So all these sorts of things you taught me, I've lived them out. So mission accomplished. You may look about all the things where you didn't get things right, all the things you didn't do right, but what did you do right? And that's the next generation is carrying on something that's worthwhile to carry on. So thus you could say mission accomplished." So one of the greatest blessings for the previous generation on that is to remind them about that. So when we kind of finish things out, just a reminder, we talked about this a little bit here recently when we were kind of building up on our Galatians study. And one of the passages we looked at was 2 Corinthians chapter 3. And how the new covenant really fits into this picture. Because you'll see some people will bring this up and say, "Well, the issue is the tablets, that covenant there at Sinai, that was getting in their way. And when you take that out of the way, then you can see the Messiah revealed." But one of the key pictures that we see, and hopefully we saw that with the passage we're looking at today, read together with the passages from there in Exodus 32 and 33 and 34, that this all comes together. The encounter that Moses was having up on the mountain, "Show me your glory. Show me who is going to go with us." So he was in the presence of God, and he brought just a shining, glowing of that presence and being with the One, down with the words of that, the testimony, the personal testimony of the Lord, engraved with the Lord's own finger there, saying, "This is the testimony. This is who I met." Okay, Moshe could see you met somebody. Well, who did you meet? Well, here's the testimony of who I met and what this One that I met, what he has to say, and what blessing that is for the entire world to gather all of them in and bring them toward this One who I met, who is also the creator of heaven and earth. So thus, when you're talking about, hey, when the veil is removed, the Messiah is revealed. What is revealed? Moshe talked to the Lord as one talked to a friend. What is that glowing? The presence. He was in the presence. So thus, when we too are like Moshe and not having to look upon those that have been in contact with the Lord with a veil on. We don't want to see it. We don't want to be called into the presence. Thus, we start seeing what this picture is of how you have the Word becoming flesh and tabernacle among us. Who is going to be sent with us? The glory of the Lord. And we see that particular passage foretold there in the prophet of Haggai, that there will be a greater glory coming into the temple than has ever come into the temple before. A greater, greater glory. And we see there in the Gospels recorded that there was a greater glory than had ever been to the temple before. Because before, you had the presence would come and the presence would go. But here, you actually had the presence walking amongst us. Wow, that is a spectacular thing. So then we look forward to the day when you actually then have the return of the presence of God here upon earth. That then you have the presence of God where the Lamb and the King reigning together there from Jerusalem, and all of the nations then going up toward the presence of the Lord, as it was always intended to be. And like we saw last time with the schematics of the temple that was foreseen, this next temple that would be, would have not just one way in, but the doors would be open because, hey, everyone, the whole mountaintop, the whole area of the city has become holy. Because why? You've had a transformation of the world that has been foretold from the very beginning. Back we go to the time of the garden, where they were fully exposed to the Lord and they felt no shame. Thus, in the world to come, we won't have anything to hide anymore, because who we were, our sins, transgressions, iniquities, have been totally covered, totally removed, gone. So that new person, new creation, will be all that's left. There will be nothing to hide anymore. No shame anymore. Because just like Moshe said, hey, heap everything on me. Well, there was one that the Lord certainly heaped everything upon. And as it says there in Isaiah 53, it pleased the Lord to crush him. But that crushing came what? From that came a blessing and release and freedom for all of us. Because of that, took upon us all of our iniquities, sins, transgressions, infirmities, took them all on. Hallelujah. So that's where we'll end things out here today. I'm sorry, Rose's hand is up there. Go ahead, and then Sam.
I want to thank you, Jeff, for your teaching. I always appreciate your teachings, but I didn't get the fourth thing that the kings were supposed to do.
Oh, they were supposed to, Deuteronomy talks about, they're supposed to write down a copy of the word, and as it mentions, to also kind of ask questions as they're going along. So not just kind of write it down as just blindly, but they're supposed to understand what it is they're writing.
Well, you said kings are not to have many wives, they're not to gather horses, they're to write down their own Torah. There was four things. What was the fourth thing?
Multiply wealth. Yes, thank you. Got my spare brain.
They are not to multiply wealth.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Go ahead, Sam.
Okay. Yeah. So, I think when we look at the setting of Mishkan, God allowed men to participate. Okay. He gave the blueprint. And then men are to build it, you know, bringing the articles, all this together. But then when we look at the first tablet, God did it by himself.
And that's with the second tablet. He says, so bring the tablet.
The first tablet, because if that had survived, Torah would be hard for us you know, to learn or to maintain. And I think God was so consistent and is still being consistent with his word that we are to procreate with him. So the first one, he cut the stone out, he wrote on it. And then men cannot, you know, even Moses, according to some of the rabbinic teaching, was it was so heavy, as what you mentioned, that he has to drop it. Because it's all kabod, it's just God, the heaviness of Yahweh in his hands, and bringing that from the holy place down to filthy place here, there is no way the atmosphere could not contain. Yeah.
And that was, I guess, one of the kind of the key thought lessons from that is that as Moshe was coming near the golden calf experience, that the glory just could not be in the presence of that going on, so far removed from that. So that's one of the, I guess, the thought lessons of it being ridiculously heavy. So that's, you know, what's thought of from the, that you could say, living parable there.
Well, it's the Aaron, because I know the, you know, the a lot of rabbinic commentary kind of, you know, build defense around Aaron, why was he punished when the rest of the people, at least the first, the punishment we saw was 3,000 die, you know, by sword. Those are the ringleaders. And then, the you know, the plague, God started. But what happened to Aaron? And one of the commentary I've read, I can't remember, but it was a rabbinic commentary, was there was a death before even Moses came down that forced, in kind of, we're going to kill you if you don't do this. They said that to Aaron, and they said probably there was a man that was killed. I forgot his name. His name was mentioned in that commentary. Or, so another thing we tend to forget here is, that's why I love that picture. Look at that. How many people there against one man? So if a mob come against you and say, we want this, I mean, you got to just like, okay, you have it. And I think, you know, we tend to forget that was the situation and the condition that Aaron was against millions of people.
Yeah, so, and when it's very interesting that you see it mentioned that there at the outset that he it talks about that when Moshe saw that Aharon had let them get out of control like that. Yeah, that is an interesting aspect, because you see one of the instructions that we had seen back in Exodus 24, where it's like you do not follow the masses in making the decision. And that's one of the challenges that comes, is that you would think, and there is a big pressure in modern society, that when you have lots of people making lots of noise, that you just go along with it. And sometimes truth, justice, whatever, takes it to the side because of the will of the masses.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.